From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 4 million years ago. As you probably remember, there wasn't a whole lot of ice in the Northern Hemisphere at the time, but thanks to global cooling, that began to change. 3.6 million years ago, the global temperature decline sped up, and by 2.7 million years ago, there were continental ice sheets. There are a number of ideas for why the ice sheets formed. None are clean enough to easily accept, and so scientists at the University of Rochester are going to study this, but you can call it reverse global warming, global cooling, trying to firm up the answer. An early bet might be on carbon dioxide, but we're going to get specific here. This is our monthly science roundtable, and we're going to have a look at this research and why it matters. You might have heard conversations about the impact of increased carbon dioxide today. What can we learn from what happened millions of years ago, and how are scientists effectively going to study it? Let me welcome my guests for the hour. Carmela Garzione is the Chair of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. And Carmela, it's nice to have you here.
Thanks, Evan. Nice to be here.
John Tardino is here as well. He's the Director of Undergraduate Programs in Geosciences at the University of Rochester. John, nice to have you.
Thanks, Evan.
Well, we all remember about 4 million years ago, and there wasn't a whole lot of ice, and that changed. By 2.7 million years ago, continental ice sheets were there, yes? And so, Carmela, is there any sort of a scientific, there's not a consensus, but is there an assumption for why that happened yet?
There are several previous hypotheses that are based on changes in ocean circulation, primarily based on the closure of ocean gateways. And so those hypotheses look at redistributing the planetary heat by changing ocean currents, also changing the warmth that's brought to high latitudes and allowing more atmospheric water vapor to enter the atmosphere and rain out in the northern hemisphere as snow. However, those hypotheses have some challenges, and we've seen increasing challenge of those hypotheses with an understanding that the gateways might have closed much earlier than people had previously thought.
Okay, well, we have all kinds of questions. Listeners, if you want to jump in on the questions of this research and the implications, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Right here in Rochester. Let me start by asking them you get this $4.24 million grant to do this research. Clearly, there is a priority for this. Is there a greater implication? Let me ask both of you. And Carmela, I'll start with you. What's the possible application and implications that come from this research?
One of the implications is that we're studying a time period that is analogous to what we're experiencing in modern CO2 emissions. So humans have been adding atmospheric CO2 to the climate system, and we're looking at modern CO2 concentrations that are equivalent to this time period of between 4 and 3 million years ago. And so by not only studying the cause of the cooling, but also studying what climate was like at that time, we might develop a clearer picture of the role in CO2 in warming, and we might better understand what climate conditions would be like under those higher CO2 times in Earth history.
John?
Yeah, I think one of the things that kind of relates to modern times is really the role of the oceans as well as the interaction between the land and the oceans. Because one of the hypotheses that we're going to be testing is really sometimes has been called the iron hypothesis. And that is, you could change the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere if you actually change the amount of biomass in the uppermost layers of the ocean. That is the plankton. That is, if you have an increased amount of dust actually reaching the upper layers of the oceans, you might actually draw down CO2. So that's one of the hypotheses that we're going to be testing. And these things are relevant for modern times, too, in terms of understanding the relationship of the oceans and the biomass to rising CO2 layers levels.
I'm curious to know if, and I hope you're insulated from this kind of thing, but you know, just for example, I think 3 or 4 days ago, NASA put out new information on Antarctic ice formation. It turns out that there is more ice than they thought. And of course, when you get a headline like that, some people say, aha, see? There's not actually a problem. There's more ice there. Even NASA admits it. Whereas if you read more about what they're saying, well, we know sea level rise is happening, but if this is not one of the contributing factors, then it creates a new mystery. You know, what does that mean for other sources, et cetera? it's obviously always much more complex than the media wants to make it. But when you're talking about researching global cooling and CO2 and these kind of things, are you insulated from any sort of public conversation? Do you feel any extra sort of either anxiety or pressure, et cetera, or does that not even come up to you? Carmela?
Well, as John mentioned, really what we're after is an understanding of the effects of iron, which is a limiting nutrient in the North Pacific, where dust is being transported, on CO2. And so the cooling that results from the algal photosynthesis and phytoplankton in the North Pacific, we still have some fundamental gaps in understanding of just how much drawdown of CO2 could occur as a result of iron fertilization of the North Pacific. And so we're really going for much more basic questions. What is the ocean's capacity to draw down CO2? And what magnitude of CO2 drawdown might result? And what is the connection between CO2 reduction and climate? We are somewhat insulated in that we're really getting back to more fundamental questions that help us understand CO2 forcing of climate.
Do you agree with that, John?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But we do always kind of, at least I think about it a little bit, because in the past, some people who have talked about iron fertilization have gotten wrapped up with people talking about engineering climate. And we don't do that. Personally, but occasionally we do get asked questions about it, and it becomes intriguing because there are aspects of this. When you learn more about the climate system, you do tend to sometimes get questions about engineering climate. So we're not directly related in that, but we are talking about some fundamental science that eventually needs to be considered for people even thinking about the potential of engineering climate in the future.
Well, I think that there's a lot of places to kind of start to walk through what's happening now and the kind of research and what they're going to study. I want to just start basically then. CO2 and its impact, what we know, whether it's today or 4 million years ago, CO2 plays a role in the climate. And, you know, what's the basic, easy description? John, you're already smiling. Carmela, well, I told you we're going to start basic. Go ahead, Carmela.
Okay, so if we look at climate at 4 million years ago, mm-hmm. The global temperatures were about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer, and the atmospheric CO2 was on the order of about 400 parts per million by volume, which is actually where we are today with human addition of CO2 to the atmosphere. And so the question we're addressing, the hypothesis we're looking at, is whether aridification, increased aridity within Asia related to the growth of mountains in Asia, allowed for conditions to become both arid enough and windy enough to loft dust from the deserts into the atmosphere and transport that material to the oceans, where iron addition would fertilize the ocean and stimulate photosynthesis in microscopic algae, for example. And so that would, in effect, draw down CO2 and cool the climate. The question of Asian aridification and dust transport has already been addressed somewhat by some of the research that I and other colleagues have been doing in Asia. So we do know that mountains were growing and basins were becoming increasingly arid at this time. And we can see evidence that dust production and transport increased at this time.
What's it look like? What's the evidence look like?
In the oceans, there is an increase in dust deposition in the deep oceans, beginning in about 3.6 million. There's also a region in China called the Lust Plateau. This is a region that experiences very thick accumulations of dust from the atmosphere that also began accumulating much more dust at about 3.5 to 3.6 million years ago. And in these interior basins north of the Tibetan Plateau, we see enhanced aridity. At the same time, we also see evidence for wind erosion of desert features that begins around the same time, but maybe a little bit later. We don't have the oldest record of wind erosion from these regions documented.
Okay. And so the research that happens next, again, you've built this kind of foundation for what you can understand already. What happens next now?
So what we're doing in this large interdisciplinary project is we're collecting more detailed records that are really focused on this important time period between 4 million and 2.5 million. Those records are geological in nature. They are paleoclimatic, so higher resolution records from the interior of Asia. They also are oceanographic. We're looking at ocean cores to understand the rate of iron-rich dust deposition in the oceans. We're looking at records of algal productivity and deposition in the deep oceans. We're also looking at records of CO2 in the atmosphere to understand whether there's a temporal relationship between ocean algal production and CO2. And finally, we're looking at records of sea surface temperatures to see if temperature corresponds with these other indicators. And perhaps the big opportunity that's pulling all this together is that we're working with a group of ocean biogeochemical modelers who can help us synthesize all of this different data to evaluate if iron additions to the ocean could have removed CO2 from the atmosphere and buried it, taken it out of the system in sufficient amount to impact climate.
I have an ignorant question about removing CO2 from the atmosphere. What would actually be the physical process? How is it removing it from the atmosphere?
That's a great question. So
that's fascinating to hear you say that.
The question. So algae is a type of plant.
Okay, yeah.
Just as trees photosynthesize, they take up CO2 to carry out photosynthesis to make the food that they need to live. And so algae do the same thing. They take up CO2 to produce sugars to live. So if you add iron to the oceans, and those algae need that iron as a nutrient, they won't become productive until they get the iron they need to photosynthesize or to grow.
Okay. We have a handful of questions from listeners, like some of our regular who love these scientific programs and want some of the details, and I'll start working through those. Jake writes, the total CO2 is only part of the picture. As far as I know, humans are increasing CO2 at a faster rate than at any prehistoric time. Can we really draw firm comparisons between prior natural changes and the current modern anthropogenic forcing? John?
Yeah, well, I think we can, both in terms of the amount and sort of the rate of increase. I think one of the things, kind of building on what Carmi was saying, is that we're trying to figure out really what was the change in the CO2. In terms of a low CO2 versus a high CO2 world, I think geologists have been thinking about global change, well before the massive amount of data was accumulated to actually convince the community that there was an anthropogenic signal in recent times. There really is compelling evidence as we go back in geological time, tens and hundreds of millions of years, times of high CO2 are very warm times, and this is related to the greenhouse effect. So when we think about the rate of CO2 increase that we're this experiment we're conducting on the planet, it's really hard for geologists to imagine ways in which the planet is not going to warm. So really, when we're looking in the past, we're just trying to understand one component of why the CO2 changed. And we think, iron fertilization is a prime reason for this. But there are other mechanisms in the past world. In terms of learning about the future world, I think, again, we're just kind of poking at little parts of the problem. The broader question that the temperature will increase in terms of increasing CO2 is something that we're not challenging, and I think many of us believe that's so so well established in the basic science that that's not really going to change much. It's just the details and how the rate of change will occur, and then some of the aspects that could be affected. For example, when we study this idea of iron fertilization, we are, in a sense, also studying how the oceans react to changes in the CO2 world. So we may have some inferences in what we learned from our project about things that could have occurred in the future.
Are you surprised once in a while to hear, I'm sure they're usually not scientists, but people talking about how, well, isn't CO2 good for the atmosphere? We'll probably get a phone call or two. And that, and I welcome anyone who wants to call with these kind of questions, but you do hear it. And as you just said, it's so well established, the impact of the modern spike in CO2. But there's still some of that pushback that, well, I thought CO2 was a good thing in the atmosphere. Are you surprised that that's still a stumbling block at times?
I'm not actually surprised. I think it's not an unreasonable thing to start with.
Sure.
I think it just, when people learn really about the full range of implications, I think they change their mind quite quickly. But as a starting point, it's not, outrageous. For example, I started out with saying that we might have more biomass than more phytoplankton in the oceans due to higher CO2 levels as we kind of fertilize the oceans. Maybe that's not a bad thing. Well, It can be a bad thing in terms of actually causing detrimental changes to the ocean if things go too far, where we could actually start to remove a lot of oxygen from the ocean. That's just kind of one example. In terms of the increase in CO2, we're talking about a rate of change that is unprecedented in geological history. So it really...
You're talking about what's happening now.
That's what's happening now.
Yes.
So if we think about it's really kind of the rate and the magnitude of change that is really so large and so dramatic that we have, the Earth, there are many very severe consequences that could happen to Earth that go beyond the question of, well, yeah, you may be living in one place where the temperature may rise and you may say, well, that could be a good thing. Well, there's someone else living on an island where their entire island disappears because of sea level change. So it's really, when you think about this on a global basis, global change or the increase in temperatures starts to become a pretty scary thing.
Let me grab a first phone call. This is Bill in Henrietta. Go ahead, Bill.
Evan, love the show. In 1973 through 74, I was up here, and I worked on the IFYGL project, geophysical project, in which we cored every 30 square foot of Lake Ontario to the depth of 25 feet. We sunk cores and we took samples and we measured them. And I think your professor is right on target. We found iron particles at 20 feet in layers. So during some million years ago, whatever the time frame it was, there was a dust storm that went nationwide. We measured it from a lot of high volume of volcanic dust that influenced that. And prior to the glacier and the ice age, there was an extreme amount of oceanographic fish population that set off that phytoplankton as food. So it kept it in balance. So something interrupted the atmosphere and the cycle of photo and phytoplankton to allow that carbon dioxide level to increase. So I just wondered if your professors have looked for that information. It's the IFYGL project, and I think those cores are stored in Oswego. I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I really haven't looked at cores from Ontario. It's possible that Asian dust, it's transported today around the globe associated with some dust storms. So it's possible that Asian dust does show up in this part of the world. So the call-in makes an interesting point. The source of dust we're looking at in the North Pacific probably has a much larger influence in the North Pacific, and so we'd stand a stronger chance of really seeing records of that in the ocean cores that we're targeting for research. But, the full extent of that dust and where it's transported and where it could be observed, That's, you know, an interesting question. Perhaps we can see evidence of it in parts of North America as well.
We've had paleoclimatologist Vas Petrenko on a number of times talking about some of the work they do drilling for ice samples, ice cores, and our listeners are always curious about process. And so Alan writes to us and says it's still unclear to him. He says, it's still unclear to me how we can study what was going on in the ocean 4 million years ago. So physically, the process. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Carmela?
Yeah, that's a good question. So so there's a international drilling effort to go out and sample parts of the ocean that are excellent targets for climate or other geologic processes. And so this effort targets sites, and the ships are equipped to be able to drill in these sites. And so we collect ocean cores that record a history, both in terms of age as well as sedimentation. And scientists can then later request those cores to study them for paleoclimate inferences or other inferences about changes in oceanographic conditions at times in the past. And so part of our project is dedicated to accessing those cores to collect new information about the climate of the oceans, the age of the sediments, the extent of algal photosynthesis and productivity deposited in those locations. And part of John's work here is to look at those cores to collect some of this data.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the cores again? I know I'm fixated on the process here, but an ice core is easier to understand for me than an ocean core, John.
Yeah, so there is this international project. It's called the Ocean Drilling Project or the International Ocean Drilling Project. Where a ship goes out for 2 months at a time, kind of a standard cruise. It's not a very seagoing ship because it has a big hole in the bottom. And through the hole in the bottom, there's actually a derrick, a drill rig on it, and a pipe is lowered down in the center of the drill ship and can drill and collect sediment cores at essentially any water depth in the ocean's basins. So this has been going on for decades, and through that we now have this this collection of ocean cores in core repositories that we can go back to and study. There's a lot of background information on these already from scientists who've been studying these for decades, but we can now go in and kind of fine-tune and look at individual layers to test whether or not they have dust or evidence of phytoplankton and things like that.
Dan wants to know, do we know what the ocean levels were 4 million years ago? I guess the level versus today, do we know?
Yeah, oceans were on the order of a few tens of meters higher 4 million years ago. So, you know, on the order of 100 feet, give or take, a couple tens of feet.
Is that all? That 4 million years ago.
Well, think about where Florida would be if the oceans were 10 meters higher. Florida.
It wouldn't be.
So it might not seem like a lot, but in terms of coverage of our continental.
Seems like a tremendous amount to me.
Yeah.
A tremendous amount. Because when we talk about sea level rise related to modern climate change, we're not talking about 100 feet. I certainly hope we are not talking about 100 feet. We're talking about something much less that still can threaten coastal communities, right?
Yes.
To make sure we're clear on that. Another listener just wanted to know about a couple of points. He said, you know, your guests talking about the current rate of change is unprecedented. How is that? My understanding, John, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that when we talk about CO2 change, CO2 change has always been sort of happening. Climate's been ebbing and flowing. The unprecedented part is the rate of change in a short amount of time. Is that correct?
That's rate and amount that we're actually putting into the atmosphere. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So we can't go back anywhere in history and see something that looks like what's happening now. Is that fair to say?
There are fast rates, but in terms of the total amount that we're actually putting in, that's really unprecedented. We really have to look at both of them together.
All right. And then a listener just writes, if modern change is unprecedented, can we draw conclusions from prehistoric levels?
Yeah, again, it's It's actually a really interesting question, because it is a certain amount of uncertainty in the modern world, and that's actually what scientists are really worried about, because there are aspects of this that we can learn about from looking in the ancient world, but yes, there are some aspects of this that are so out of bounds that we have to be concerned about this. This concerns the question of thresholds. Now, you talked a little bit about sea level change. One of the things that often comes up that scientists are worried about is that we might have more dramatic, rapid changes in sea level. If we can reach, let's say, threshold values where all of a sudden the ocean starts reacting differently than what we expect it to be reacting to. So there is this aspect of it. But still, within the larger scale process, we think that we can learn something about the processes just by studies like ours.
Okay. And again, if you're just joining us, the work that they are in the process of doing and will be studying is looking at atmospheric dust that came from growth of mountains, desert, and more arid regions over the again, this wasn't one single event in a short amount of time. This was a lot of dust in the atmosphere over more than a million years, right, Carmela? Mm-hmm. And then that dust ends up in the ocean, which has an impact on CO2 levels, et cetera. And that could be, you know, that could be your answer for how you went from 4 million years ago, no continental ice sheets in the northern hemisphere, to 2.7 million years ago, continental ice sheets. And is there a single signature that will you have any sort of a moment or a conclusion that says, we were right, we've got it? You know, what is that process going to be like?
You know, that's a great question for science in general. There's rarely a moment in the process of discovery in science where you say, I've proven it. I know I'm right.
Because your colleagues are going to come in for peer review and try to take it apart?
Yeah. I mean, there are uncertainties in science, and part of the nature of science is building evidence that then opens up new questions that are tested with new lines of inquiry. So I would say that there might be a moment where we can say we are confident that Asian dust contributions to the North Pacific had an impact on CO2 and cooling. However, there will always be some questions remaining regarding the influence of iron fertilization on CO2 drawdown at this time period. And I'm sure additional research will need to be done to understand that relationship.
What's the timeline for the current research then?
It's a 5-year project, and we get started this year. So we should be wrapping up our work in 2020.
Do we get more excited on the outside? Do you feel, is it a long process that, you know, you're sort of even keel about, or do you feel a sense of sort of enthusiasm that you're helping at least tell the story climatologically? And it's sort of a climatological mystery that at least we had some ideas about but have never really solved. Does that appeal to you, or does that, again, is it more day-to-day drudgery?
Oh, my goodness. Well, science is never day-to-day drudgery. I think what drives us as scientists is curiosity, and especially curiosity in this case that has implications for modern climate questions. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be embarking on this. It's a project that I've been considering for a long time, many years. And so to see it come to fruition is very exciting.
John?
Yeah, I think one of the things that excites me about the project is that, particularly looking at from the deep sea realm, is that when you go back to this idea of these deep sea cores, and we collect deep sea cores, we have layers within those cores, and those layers are time. So, you know, if we were able to, for example, find evidence for dust, find evidence for that the oceans had increased productivity, increased phytoplankton, and we had other evidence of CO2 changing right at that time interval, and that's important, right at that time interval, that would be an incredible result. So there would still be questions, but it still would be a very substantial step forward. So that prospect is really exciting. And I think it's something that you can sometimes some projects are very difficult to explain to a beginning student. This is one that has that potential goal that's pretty straightforward. It may not be there, it may be there, but that's something that we could explain, and it's one potential outcome here, that you could actually see all these things in one particular sediment core.
Our monthly science roundtable is looking at the science and the research on global cooling that happened 4 million years ago until about roughly 2.7 million years ago. And our guests are in the middle of that research right now. Carmela Garzione, who's the professor and chair of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. She helped write that grant proposal, a more than $4 million grant proposal, a big success. And by the way, we've talked in recent months on how hard it is to get thumbs up for some of these grant projects. So this is a very, very significant grant and a chance at research. And John Tarduno's here. He's a professor and director of undergraduate programs in geosciences, the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. We're going to get to more of your questions in just a moment on the Monthly Science Roundtable after this short break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, it's our monthly Reporters Roundtable. Reporters from some of our news partners across the region are going to be here talking about election matters. It is Election Day. We'll talk about the issues that have impacted these campaigns the most. Then second hour, how would you map Benjamin Franklin's social network? How about studying 20,000 letters? That fascinating story is Tuesday. Talk to you then.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Children's Book Festival. The 19th annual festival, featuring more than 40 children's authors and illustrators, takes place on Saturday, November 7th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Monroe Community College. rcbfest.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests are studying what happened around 4 million years ago to 2.7 million years ago with an idea about what might have caused the formation of continental ice sheets in the northern hemisphere. And it's a really, really interesting kind of research that, yes, it goes back millions of years, but it's certainly interesting to talk about in the context of what is happening right now on our planet. And I keep reminding myself that, unfortunately, the human lifetime is so short that we have such a hard time getting our head around timescales that I actually think... I was talking to Adam Frank about this recently. I sort of think that the average human lifetime is so short that we might never grapple with a species about seeing a big picture of, say, climate change or anything else that might be causing us possible harm, just because it's so hard to see in a lifetime. Because, again, we're talking about more than a million years. And so one of our listeners wanted to know about, are there concerns about current dust in the atmosphere from whatever source impacting the oceans, impacting CO2, impacting climate long term, and how would we know about it? So first of all, let's tackle that question the listener had about current dust. Is there a concern about that?
Very good question. So we live in a relatively warm time period in Earth history, and it's called an interglacial. But if you looked at the climate 15,000 years ago, Rochester was under more than a kilometer of ice. And so it's really those cooler time periods that are dustier in terms of atmospheric transport of desert dust material. And so under current conditions with the warming we're seeing, the trend or tendency would be for the Earth's climate to become less dusty, not more dusty. The caveat is that humans are also impacting vegetation. And so to some extent, aridification is enhanced when we put extra stress on semi-arid environments and the vegetation in those environments. And so that's a potential source of additional dust is human impacts on those environments, say by overgrazing or change in land use.
Do you share the concern about just the way we struggle? I do it too. I mean, I struggle with the question on our lifetime versus a million years. I mean, who can really get their head around that? But, the work that you're doing looks at events that are happening over hundreds of thousands of years. Is that going to be difficult, you think, for us as a species to really grapple with, Carmela?
I'm not sure I understand the nature of the question. Do you mean...
Are you confident in us as a species to be able to say, hey, even if I'll never see it in my lifetime. For example, the New York Times had a story a couple months ago. If all of the ice caps melted today, it would still be maybe my grandchildren's generation before we saw catastrophic ocean change, et cetera.
Well, that's a little bit of an incorrect statement. And
okay.
I do think that we are already seeing the effects of climate change today. Rates of sea level rise are increasing, and those rates are continuing to increase. And we really don't know at what point those rates will begin to level out. So that's just one example. Ocean acidification is another example. The additional CO2 in the atmosphere is changing surface ocean chemistry, making oceans more acidic, and which is affecting coral reef health and the health of other calcifying organisms. So these are very obvious and fast changes that we're observing today.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I was in the Arctic this summer at 82 degrees north, and in the Arctic, the changes, modern changes, are really dramatic. So, even a few decades ago, I think we would not have predicted that these changes would have been so obvious. But in a sense, I think your question is becoming moot in the sense that the changes are becoming so dramatic that we are going to see them. But also, there is this aspect that some of the more dramatic changes that we are inferring in studies like ours do take longer time periods. But the inferences are that some aspects of these could occur on much shorter timescales, because we are forcing climate so hard by what man is doing to climate system.
And I would, obviously, I wouldn't disagree with a single point you just made, but some of what Carmela is saying is, well, we're already seeing it, you know, and we're seeing it in various ways. We're not seeing it enough for our species to unequivocally, being by being across the species, say, I get it now. All right, I see it. I guess that's part of what I'm saying, is there's still a window for people to say, I don't know, you know, come on. That's kind of where what I'm presenting is this issue that for some reason we can still find resistance. We're still seeing that kind of resistance, right?
Yeah, well, I think in the scientific community, there's
I'm not saying in the scientific community.
And I think that the scientific community maybe isn't able to effectively communicate all of the information that we have to convince the general public. And it really is our job to help convince the general public. But, you know, I think people tend to... they gravitate toward opinions that they're comfortable with. And when it's hard to understand all the evidence, it might be more comforting to pick and choose a line of evidence, okay, even if it is somewhat restricted,
sure,
that feels more comfortable.
You agree, John?
Yeah, I agree, of course, with what Carmi has said. I mean, I think your question is an interesting one. I mean, I think, you know, when you start talking about humans as a species, that becomes a little bit difficult because we're an adaptable species. So, you know, certain amounts of global change are things that we're going to adapt to. But the disasters associated with them, it would be unfortunate if we those became so commonplace that we just adapt to those also. It's a very unusual question that you ask. I tend to think that some of the more dramatic changes of things that are now are foreseeable, like no ice in the Arctic, perhaps would really be a tipping point for the last bastions of holdouts of people who don't believe in these processes. But that's just my opinion.
All right, let me get back to the phones. And this is, I believe this is Al in Dansville. Go ahead, Al.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
And an excellent, extraordinarily good discussion of the science. I was curious, using the metaphor of zipping and unzipping global climate changes over time, In other words, the researchers will be looking at a past time, and there's, of course, in science, quite a difference between correlation and causation, making changes difficult to define as one or the other. So when you think of the past and the oncoming of the Pleistocene ice sheets that followed that period, right now we're talking about the present and the remarkably accelerated changes that we see now in an unprecedented way, where sometimes the term tipping points is used. You refer to ocean acidification. I can imagine the thermal haline effect that creates ocean mixing over a very long period of time. And I can imagine Arctic tundra releasing methane, which is a much more accelerating climate greenhouse gas than CO2. So the question about zipping is, you're going to be looking at a time where essentially we were zipping up for winter, that is this incredibly cold period of Arctic glaciation and continental glaciation, whereas now we're thinking about the end of the ice age, that is the end of polar ice caps, and in a sense the unzipping of this. So I wonder if you could just generally talk about this cause and effect question, because some things might be byproducts, precipitation of iron in the ocean, for example, and others might be more leading changes. Of course, CO2 in the atmosphere and methane are clearly greenhouse gases. So I'll take your discussion, if you would be willing to, off the line. Thank you.
Thanks, Al.
Nice question. So the types of problems I look at on the long time scale are the role of tectonics on climate. And on long time scale, tectonics may play an important role in the waxing and waning of CO2. And so, for example, the weathering of silicate minerals has the ability to draw down CO2 on long time scales, and it's a force that brings us into colder climate conditions over million year time scales. And so one of the key components of this project, looking back 4 to 2.7 million years ago, is what the forcing mechanism was for dust generation in Asia. Was it related to the growth of mountain ranges in Central Asia that led to intensely arid conditions that could have generated the dust that then gets deposited and enhances photosynthetic productivity in the oceans? To address that, we really need to understand if Asian dust led dust deposition globally. And so we are actually tackling that question, looking at both Pacific ocean cores for their input of dust compared to other dusty parts of the world that shouldn't have seen dust increase as early as we see it in the North Pacific if it was caused by another process. But that's a very challenging question in science, lead-lag relationships, because you're absolutely right, correlation is not causation. So you really need a way around that that kind of assumption that if things are correlated, then one must be causing the other.
Our producer, Megan Mack, corrects me. And of course, Carmela was right and I was wrong. So now let me correct the record. I did misspeak. I'm trying to recall the Times article. So here's what the Times article reported on. It wasn't if you melted all of the ice today that it would be generations. It would be that if you burned all of the fossil fuels on this planet right now, it would lead to a sea level rise on the orders of what we saw 100 feet higher 4 million years ago. It would lead to that kind of sea level rise. But if you burned all the fossil fuels, if you could somehow do that right now in one day, it would still be roughly my grandchildren's generation before they actually saw all of the melting happening. Now, if you could melt everything right now, of course, that would be instantly catastrophic. That's what the Times article said. We're not going to burn all the fossil fuels now, but we're we're still very happily addicted to the grid of fossil fuels. So that's so sorry about that, Carmela. See, that's she was. Thank you, Megan. Thank you for correcting the record on that. I want to get back to the phones, and this is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I tune in a little late, but I'd like to ask your guests. I understand based on some of the readings I've done and what I've heard today, the Arctic ice is melting. I had heard that the Antarctic ice was actually accumulating, but my question is this. 14,000 years ago, we were under a mild glacier right here in Rochester, and, you know, it has melted, and that melted not because of man-made climate change, but natural forces. I would submit the sun and naturally emitted methane, volcanoes, other sources of methane that come naturally from the earth. I would submit might contribute, and man would contribute very little. My question is, the melting of the Arctic ice, is that what's the difference between that melting and the melting of the glaciers that were in Rochester 15,000 years ago?
All right, John, stay on the line. And John Tarduno, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, so what's happening today is really unusual in geological history. When we think about when Rochester was under ice, that was a period that we call the last glacial maximum, and that was a natural variation of glacial interglacial times, and we are in a glacial interglacial time now. We should, if there were no influence to man, actually be heading back into a glacial period, not probably immediately, but in the next 5,000 years or so. But we've interrupted that cycle by this huge amount of CO2 that we've actually put into the atmosphere. So you asked several different questions, but I think one of the huge differences between the melting of the ice in the Arctic right now versus what happened in terms of the melting of the ice sheets in that were in Rochester or mountain glaciers is one of timescales. We could see all the ice gone in the Arctic by 2050, maybe before that, maybe 2030. Whereas the melting of the ice in Rochester was still an event that occurred over many thousands of years. So there is this huge difference in timescales, in the natural kind of variations that we see in terms of glacial interglacial times that affected North America and what's happening now.
Well, what about the Antarctic and also the contribution of the sun and naturally emitted methane? I understand Mars' surface temperature has increased over since it's been measured by some of our equipment on Mars. So what would contribute to Mars versus what would contribute to the Earth? I know I asked a number of questions there. But.
Yeah, well, the solar aspect is really important, and scientists have been kind of poring over the data to see if the modern change in temperature could be related to the solar aspects. And solar changes are just not adequate to account for this change in temperature that we're seeing. And many, many people have kind of looked at that. In terms of what's happening in Antarctica, well, as global climate actually warms, there will be places that will have more precipitation, and there will be potential where there will be some glacial advances in some individual cases. But overall, the temperature is actually warming. In terms of what's happening in Mars, well, Mars actually undergoes changes in its orbit, much in the same way that Earth undergoes changes in its orbit. So Mars will actually undergo times of relative global cooling and global warming, not unlike our glacial interglacial cycles, but much more subdued. So, but Mars doesn't have a civilization there pumping in CO2 into its atmosphere. So,
well, that's my point. There's not man-made warming of Mars. It's due to solar intervention. So, why couldn't you make the same causation effect for Earth?
Because when you actually look at that amount of solar change on Earth and do the calculations, you can't account for the temperature change.
Okay. I'm not convinced, but thank you. thank you for the answer.
Thank you, John. Oh, my gosh. I thought for a second. See, John Tarduno might not know this, but I thought we almost had an amazing moment on this program, John, because what you don't know is that our friend John, who's a very nice guy, is a regular caller. And whenever climate comes up, John likes to weigh in. And I've always asked him, what's it going to take to change your mind, you know, because I'm an evidence guy, right? My mind will change. I thought you did it. I thought you did. It turns out you didn't. And you gave him a scientific substantive answer, and that didn't work. But I thought for a second. Well, we've almost run out of time. That was sort of a depressing note to the end of it. But, John, thanks for the phone call. Carmela, let's wrap just with some thoughts here. For our listeners who missed it, we've got about 30 seconds left here. You've got over the next 5 years or so, you've got a lot of work to do. You're trying to answer a great scientific question, which is what formed these continental ice sheets. You know, what's the working idea in about 30 seconds? What do you think happened, and what are you going to be studying? Go ahead.
So, if the hypothesis we're testing is correct, then the growth of mountain ranges and isolation of very arid basins in the northern part of the Tibetan Plateau generated dust that transported iron, a limiting nutrient in the North Pacific, to stimulate algal production in the North Pacific. That drew down atmospheric CO2 and led to cooling of the climate, eventually building up ice sheets in the northern hemisphere.
So 4 million years ago, there were no ice sheets in the northern hemisphere, and what an interesting question to study. Thanks for the hour that you spent with us today, Carmela and John, doing this interesting work, and I hope we can come back and talk about it again sometime as well.
Thanks for having us, Evan. This is great.
And maybe, John, the next time, our friend John in Rochester, maybe we'll get together for a cup of coffee. And he says, you did it. You changed my mind. It's been our monthly Science Roundtable. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Mike Black, who engineered the program today, and Megan Mack, producer. This is member-supported public radio.